This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this podcast. I'm Helen Needham. As humans, we are, I think, inclined towards order. Mostly, we like to arrange our houses, gardens, towns, cities, and even our countryside to look, well, nice. We are often repelled or disturbed by disorder, mess, or neglect, even though it might have been a result of our own activity. Cal Flynn is the author of Islands of Abandonment, Life in the Post-Human Landscape. It's a book which charts her journeys within Scotland and all around the world in search of abandoned places. From the Bings of West Lothian to the forests around Chernobyl in Ukraine, Cal is interested in observing, in great detail, how nature reclaims these places, often with unexpected ecological results. Cal lives in Stromness in the Orkney Islands, where I was visiting recently to attend the folk festival. I managed to grab her for a chat, and as we sat on a bench overlooking the water, I asked her to describe what we could see.
We're sitting on one of the piers that jets out into Stromness Bay, and we're looking at the lifeboat and Merlin 2, which is a very multicoloured little creel boat, and the ferry pier. And the reason I love being down here is it's just the way that life in Stromness is so intertwined with the sea and the lives of people who live in the sea, who are constantly coming in and out of this little harbour. So it's nice to feel a part of it, even if I myself am not.
Yeah. And how did you end up here?
So my partner Richard retrained as a primary school teacher when we were in our 30s, and we moved up. This was his first job, and we've been living here ever since. So that was his probationary year, and then we decided to stay on the island. A wonderful thing about Orkney is that it's got this amazing culture and sense of community and a real sense of identity as itself, and that's really wonderful. So it's also quite friendly, because you do worry if you move to a very small community that it might be inwards looking, but we find the opposite. It's been very friendly and easy to join.
And since you've moved here, did you actually write Islands of Abandonment whilst you were here?
I finished it here. I'd started the research while living in Edinburgh, and then I think I still had about 6 or 7 months of the writing while I was here. So most of it was written in a small house by the Church of Scotland in Stromness, looking over the churchyard.
It's an astonishing book, and I feel like my mind has been opened, but I've been so moved by it. You're really writing about different places in the world that are, shall we say, wild or have been left or abandoned. There's so many places to talk about, because you actually go to lots of different places, but shall we talk about some of the ones in Scotland? You start in the Firth of Forth.
That's right, yeah. So this was, well, a series of islands that I could actually see from my tenement building. So Inchkeith and Inchmickery, although that was slightly out of sight. And all the other Forth islands actually are really interesting examples of how the wild can really coexist quite closely alongside major urban developments, or people generally. So it's in the middle of a busy shipping channel, but Inchkeith particularly has become notable for large bird colonies. So the seabirds come in pretty much this time of year. and they set up their colonies over winter. They have seal pupping, and that takes over the island completely. You're not recommended to land on these islands at that time because they're just absolutely crawling with seals. And it's that sense of abandonment, of something having fallen from human purposes or human use, but it being taken over by other species and it having a new kind of role or niche in the world.
And was that, because it was close to home, was that one of the things that actually inspired the wider journeys then?
Yes, I think so. Also the Bings, the West Lothian Bings, which form chapter one. Again, this was something that I was used to driving past or going past on the train, even flying over. And I'd never really thought about them. So there's these huge sort of rose gold land masses, and they are the remnants of the mining industry of the 19th century. They would have been this gravelly stuff called shale. It was superheated to produce a kind of paraffin-type oil. And then the leftover, the spent shale, was just piled up in these enormous bings, as they're described, these spoil heaps. And what's happened over time is that they've become recolonized by lots of different types of plants through this amazing process called sort of seed rain, or also seeds dropped by the droppings of birds. And you get these very weird feral ecosystems, which are incredibly biodiverse and therefore quite valuable in their own way. And so these sites that were the epitome of being unvaluable have now become incredibly interesting from a scientific perspective, as well as representing some of the industrial heritage of the area.
Because they're not always perceived in a very positive way from the human perspective, are they?
I think originally not. I suppose because they were enormous waste heaps, and they were a little bit dangerous too, so sometimes they might reignite. I know that there were at least a small number of cases where children were burnt, and so that no longer happens. It took quite a long time for them to settle down, and I think they kind of became the sort of wallpaper to people's lives. You know, you stop paying attention to them, they're just there, they're kind of like big hills. But some of them are amazing, so like the Five Sisters, which is set up in a kind of scallop shape. It's really a monumental landmark. You know, it's an incredible thing to go and walk up, and it's quite easy to access most of these bings. Although you have to be careful, there are a few sort of mine shafts and things around, so check your maps.
You write in great detail about an island not so far from here as well.
Absolutely. So I went to visit Swona, which is between the Orkney Islands, where I live now, and the north coast of Scotland. It's in the Pentland Firth. There's actually two abandoned islands there, one called Swona, the smaller one, which I visited, and Stroma, which is larger, but is still being farmed with sheep. I was interested in Swona particularly because there is a small herd of feral cattle living on the island. I guess I was interested in the sort of philosophical question that they seem to pose, which is, when do these feral animals start being wild again? You know, is it through their wild behaviour, in which case they are already behaving wild now, or they act a lot more like wild horses or wild deer? They don't really enjoy the company of humans and can be a little bit aggressive if you get between them and their calves. Or is it something more genetic? Is it something that's inherent to the animal itself, in which case maybe they can never be wild again? And so I was interested in that, but also the experience of being in, I suppose, extreme isolation on these islands. I was dropped off by a local boatman and left for 24 hours and picked up again the next day. And in that short space of time, while I was really quite safe, or I felt myself rationally to be safe, I did also feel that it did some very strange things to my mind of being alone and being in the sort of remnants of other people's lives. It was a very sort of frightening time for me. It was a bit of a gothic horror.
Yeah, I got that sense when I was reading it. I could feel my heartbeat racing, actually. I was just imagining, you know, when you were sleeping. Well, the guy Hamish had advised you to sleep in the house and not sleep outside the house because of the cattle, basically. But, you know, hearing the noises when you're in the house and so on, gosh, I can't imagine you got very much sleep.
No, I don't think so. And it was a solstice, so it was pretty bright, you know, outside. And so I just remember that night as being this sort of long, never-ending limbo land of being on edge. And very quickly I felt that I wasn't able to eat. I couldn't relax. All of these kind of things that I associate with, maybe with watching a sort of horror movie or something like that.
Yeah, your mind must be going in all sorts of places. But the interesting thing there about the cattle was because they've, as you said, they've just been left, and then so have the corpses as well, that you actually had such a physical reaction to one of the cadavers.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, of course they're not being cleaned up afterwards as they might on a normal farm, so you do stumble upon the corpse of a cow here or there, and there's quite a lot of them, and they are quite powerful and smelling, you know, and that, I think, caught me off guard, and it was probably one of the things that contributed towards my sort of psychological reaction to being on the island.
Plus, of course, the bird, because the bird is their home too, isn't it? So when you're wandering about, they're thinking, who the hell's this in my territory?
Yeah, that's right. I think I was a little bit naive because I wanted to go out during the seabird breeding season because that's when you see all of these amazing species. But of course, that's the season when they are least happy to see you. And so I accidentally blundered into an Arctic tern colony and was dive bombed and scratched by them. And then I blundered into an area where bonksies or great skuas were living, and they can be pretty aggressive. They sort of spit and vomit in your direction, that kind of thing. And sort of was like toppling from section to section. And I keep seeing to move into a new country, a new region of different bird territory, which I would upset afresh, and so I ended up taking shelter with the puffins and sitting with the puffins quietly for a while.
Yeah, the puffins are a bit more chilled, aren't they? But I suppose it is one of these places that is a rare example of somewhere that humans are not the dominant species.
I think so. I definitely had that sense of this not being my place, and that helped me feel sort of out of place and uncomfortable, and really the birds were giving much more than they got. You know, it was my mere presence was enough to set up almost what felt like a kind of civil war against my presence on the island, and the oyster catchers were following me around and shrieking, and it was just like, I don't know, being very close to like a car alarm. You know, it was like constant in my head the whole time, and that added to my sense of anxiety.
And what did you take from that then, in terms of the themes of the book?
I think what I took from that was this idea that once you allow a place to rewild, whatever that means to you, you can't expect it then to be a human-friendly place. And so these animals were used to having the island to themselves, and my presence was therefore entirely a negative from their point of view. And although I had sort of imagined it might be a nice thing for me to watch, and it was if I stayed very still and hidden, you know, they weren't pleased to see me.
Yeah, well, there's another chapter which has really sort of stuck with me since I read it, which is about the abandoned industrial shipyards of New Jersey and the toxicity in that part of the world as a result of human industrialization. I just found it completely shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we find in Newark Bay and in similar harbours like it, i.e. the places that were centres of industry in the 20th century, when some very noxious chemicals were being made and allowed to pollute the waterways before it was understood how noxious they were, you find that a lot of the native flora and fauna have died off, because it's impossible to live in a place like this. But what is slowly beginning to happen, and very slowly, is that these places are becoming repopulated, sometimes with particular fish species that are evolving to survive in what is essentially completely poisonous waters. So in Newark Harbour, it is the mummichog. It's a small, very silvery fish, and they're usually seen as indicator species. They don't like pollution, so they're some of the first to go, but they are coming back in, and it's thought that this is because they're a very genetically diverse, very numerous species, and therefore a few of them would have been somehow immune to the effects of things like PCBs and dioxins, which are found in the waters there. And they have begun to repopulate the area. That's not to say they're necessarily healthy fish. This is happening in a number of places, and they find they might have tumours or they might have sort of skin complaints, but the point is that they're surviving in waters they shouldn't be able to survive in. And then populations slowly over time become established, and all of those populations have these kind of immunities to the toxins that they're swimming in. So this is a way that nature begins to rebuild or reclaim, just through these natural processes of evolution. And this is rapid evolution of a kind in response to human obstacles that have been put up that we are only really recently sort of coming to terms with or coming to understand.
And it's astonishing, really, isn't it? But there are some massively negative consequences of this, and you described the fact that even an orca that was washed up on the west coast of Scotland some of these chemicals, high levels of chemicals, could be traced.
Yes, that's right. In fact, there is a pod of orcas known to frequent the west coast of Scotland, and they haven't been able to breed. Their fertility is very, very low due to the amount of PCBs that have built up in their systems. Essentially, what happens is that there might be low levels of these incredibly toxic chemicals in the water that gets absorbed into things, very small creatures, which get eaten by bigger creatures, but get eaten by bigger creatures. This is called biomagnification, and it means that the chemical levels become very concentrated in creatures like killer whales, because they are eating slightly less contaminated creatures, and it builds up in their own bodies.
So actually the consequences are far and wide from that particular part of the world. It has a wider global effect.
Yes, that's right. And also, it was not only in America where these chemicals were being released. Certainly large amounts were being released in American harbours, but also in the UK. I know in the Straits of Gibraltar, the killer whales down there are very impacted. So this is a problem that's all over the world. And we are seeing the effects. You know, still today, these chemicals will effectively last forever. They have half-lives of hundreds of thousands of years.
And talking of that, you also go to Chernobyl in Ukraine to see what the consequences of that huge nuclear disaster are still today.
I was very lucky to be able to access Chernobyl because obviously the security situation has changed there so much since 2019, which was when I visited. But what I found when I visited at the time was that there's this enormous region, which is the exclusion zone. And within the exclusion zone, the pattern of radiation is very uneven. They describe it as a sort of leopard spotting pattern. So next to the reactor and heading off in, I believe, a sort of northern or northeasterly direction, there is very heavy contamination. And in other parts of the zone, it can be very light. So it was suggested to me that during my 2 days in the zone, probably the amount of radiation that I personally encountered would have been roughly the same to something like a transatlantic flight. But some areas of the zone are very contaminated, especially in the sort of red forest area, which is where we saw some Russian soldiers digging trenches and things. And in those areas, some scientists have warned of big impacts on lots of different species, but perhaps the most worryingly being small insects and the kind of microbes that are to do with the dissolving of leaf litter. Other scientists are more optimistic, especially those that deal with, say, large mammals, because those animals move around the zone. They aren't always in very contaminated areas, and even if they are, they might survive long enough to breed, and that's certainly what we're seeing. There was a sevenfold increase in wolves since 1986 in that region. We've also seen a return of bears after more than 100 years. And so the picture is mixed. Nobody's saying that the contamination is a good thing, but I think the question over whether the lack of disturbance in the region from an environmental perspective, and certainly from the perspective of creatures that don't like human disturbance, it's been a sort of overall upward trend.
Which is surprising in many ways. We don't have time to sort of go into the other details of the many chapters that you've written and the many journeys that you've taken, but I wonder where you're at with all of this now. If you're feeling a sense of positivity, or what's your view on the plight of our world?
Yeah, I think overall my feeling was one of a sort of gentle optimism. You know, this sense that actually a lot of the places that I would have assumed were too broken to recover have in some form. And I think that point in some form is an important one to make, because these places will not necessarily return to what they were before exactly. Perhaps if a forest has been cut down, the forest can regrow. But if you build on it, the habitat that will grow on it will be somewhat different. Perhaps it will be richer in, say, invertebrate life or reptile life or you know, the kind of birds that like to roost in old buildings. So there can be benefits of different types of habitat. That's recognised now within the UK, as brownfield sites are often classed as open mosaic habitats, and these are considered to be a valuable biodiverse habitat. And so we can understand that land can be valuable in different forms, even if it's not sort of beautiful in a picturesque way. And then the sort of third category would be these ones that are very, very badly contaminated. And there it's more looking for you know, the grass in the cracks in the pavement, the light in the cracks, because what we see there is a recovery, for sure, but a very, very slow one. And so what we have to learn to do is to not damage the world in such a way that it will last for so long. So these long-lasting chemicals, PCBs and dioxins, it's now no longer legal to release them, but that is inevitably happening, at least on a small level, at some place in the world. But also climate change, that counts as a very long-term change, and probably one of the biggest existential threats to the natural world. We think that maybe 10% of all species might go extinct due to climate-related changes. So we have to consider that as one of these sort of major long-lasting impacts we are having on the world around us and try and limit what we do.
Living in a place like Orkney, then, does this make you feel a sense of positivity then towards the future of our planet?
Well, one thing that I do take a lot of hope from is the growth of the green energy sector up here, which is, you know, is a major employer. There's lots of really exciting stuff going on. We have loads of things like electric cars. And so that feels to me like the local community is sort of way ahead of certainly other places that I've lived. And also, of course, you know, we are surrounded by, you know, we're lucky enough to see all of these amazing seabirds, to see killer whales and all sorts of species. And that does give you a sense that life is continuing, and certainly in less human impacted places. So I think what that does do is it sort of reminds you on a daily basis to love the natural world, to appreciate it, and to try and do what you can.
Would your message be that there are places that should just be left then, that where the human hand should just be withdrawn, let nature do its thing?
I suppose. I mean, I guess my position is not to sort of make moral judgments, because I find the more I dig into them, the more difficult it is to say what we should and should not do, apart from perhaps to damage indiscriminately. You know, that seems fairly cut and dry. But beyond that, it's difficult. It's not so much that I'm arguing that we should create more abandoned places. It's more like these abandoned places exist. What can we learn from them? I describe a lot of the sites in my book as being forbidden experiments. So it would be immoral to recreate them, to make these situations come around. And I think that's how I've begun to think about it. And that idea of wilderness is a little bit of a complicated prospect when you drill down into it. What exactly is it? We don't have a very strong sense of exactly what it is. And I find that interesting, because the concept of it is yet somehow still very valuable and powerful and drives a lot of our work with the natural world.
I have to say, that's one of the things that I really liked about your book, is the fact that you weren't making those moral judgments. You were just presenting actually what you had discovered yourself, with the personal journeys going to these actual places, but also all the research that you've done. So it was very refreshing.
Thanks.
And any thoughts on you're going to be thinking about doing another book? Which direction are you going in next? Are you prepared to reveal?
sort of. I'm still at kind of an early stage, so it feels a little bit woolly at the moment, but I'm still really interested in this idea of kind of the margins between human and non-human. I'm interested in the idea of wilderness, and I'm just seeing if I can make that work at the moment as a bit come up with my new concept. So I'm doing a lot of reading. Yeah.
Thanks very much to Cal Flynn for taking the time to speak with me in Stromness. I can't recommend Islands of Abandonment enough. Such a well-researched book, which offers alternative but robust perspectives on the natural world. You can find out more at her website, calflynn.com. Please do get in touch and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We love receiving your emails from all corners of the globe. Honestly, it does cheer us up. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'm Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.